I think we've reached the time to start, and we have a minion, so we can get going. I apologize if anyone is going to miss a few moments at the beginning, but it will be recorded and available on the Torrin Motion website. Thank you, everybody, again, for being here, coming tonight, whoever is here, and Jay and Shalom and the whole crew at Torrin Motion. Tonight, we're going to try something that's pretty aggressive, and we'll see how we do on that, and that's to review three books by the chief rabbi, Jonathan Sacks. He recently became a lord, but someone like me, who grew up in the 70s and 80s, I have trouble referring to anybody as Lord Sacks or anything like that, because immediately comes to mind as Lord Vader. You know, he's not some sort of Jedi who went to the dark side. So let's just call him the chief rabbi. So three books. So the chief rabbi writes pretty much a book a year at least. Extremely prolific, extremely thoughtful. most of his books are for the Jewish community, but every once in a while he reaches out and writes for the general community, whether in England, where he's the chief rabbi, or for the entire world. And what we're going to discuss tonight are three books, and really, the only chiddush I have, the only insight that I have the whole evening is what I'm about to tell you right now, and that's that there's a connection between these three books, because otherwise you might not have noticed that there is a connection. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I believe. And that's, the three books are as follows, and they're up on the screen. Number one is The Dignity of Difference, How to Avoid the Clash of Civilizations, that was published in 2002. Number two, The Home We Built Together, Recreating Society, published 5 years later in 2007. And Future Tense, A Vision for Jews and Judaism, the Global Culture, published in 2009. Actually, it was only published in England in 2009. The American edition is not yet available. So how did I get mine? Well, I ordered it in England and had it shipped to me in the U.S. There's a new edition that should be coming out shortly, I think, in early 2010 in the U.S. So far, from what I can tell, the only difference is the cover. They have a snazzier cover for the U.S. market. Just like I know Harry Potter had different covers for England and the U.S., the chief rabbi also has different covers for England and the U.S. But I jumped the gun and I bought mine in England. And what I see is a common thread connecting all three books, which we'll discuss. But there's also progression. And when I saw the third book, and I recognized the connection between the previous two books, I realized what I believe the chief rabbi was trying to do. So the first book we're going to discuss, The Dignity of Difference, is where the chief rabbi saw problems in the, really describes, problems to fix them in general. He doesn't give specifics, but in general, what we need to do to fix those problems. The second book, 5 years later, is the problems that he sees in Western society, specifically England, but it really is any country in the Western world, what problems they're facing and how to fix those. So he goes from the very general of the entire culture to specific, a country. And the third book is about Israel and how to fix the problems, those similar problems that are facing the state of Israel and what we can do to fix them in Israel. So it's really, you know, from universal to specific and then to very specific. And what we'll do tonight is we'll go through all those problems and solutions and show how he addresses them. And again, there's a limit to what we could do in 1 hour. He had three books to do it in then, and really each chapter in each book is a full lecture in itself. So what you're getting tonight in 1 hour is about 50 hours worth of lectures. So we're going to be quickly, but really something for Torrin Motion. Only in Torrin Motion can you get really that much bang for your buck, 50 lectures in one. So let's get going. We'll talk about The Dignity of Difference. Let me pull up the cover here so you can see what it looks like. Dignity of Difference, as we'll get to shortly, we won't really talk about it too much, is probably the chief rabbi's most controversial book. See, it's not a beautiful cover. What you see there on the cover is the Tower of Babel, Migdal Bavel, which is all civilization coming together and totally miscommunicating, leading to dispersion and disunity and conflict. And that's really the theme of the book. It's a perfect cover. I mean, it was not such a complicated cover, but it's really perfect in describing what the problem is. Let's just note, first of all, when this was published. It was published in 2002. This is the post-9/11 book of the chief rabbi. Now, most of us probably remember 9/11 and how the world was after. I live in New York City. I was in Manhattan on 9/11. That's a whole other story in itself. But the climate afterwards was so different than what it was previously and where we've gotten to now. So this, to some degree, this book has 9/11 shock written all over it. On the other hand, it's valid because we still face many of the challenges we faced after 9/11, even without the shock. So what the Chief Rabbi does is he describes a number of problems that face society today that are unique to the 21st century. The first he discusses is economic. And let me preface this all by saying this book, of all the three books we're going to discuss, the first book, Dignity of Difference, is different in that it's not written in Brisker style. Let me explain to you what I mean by Brisker style. The style, to say Brisker Chiddush, an insight, is the first you build up the question. You start with a question, then you ask more questions, and you build it up, and build it up till you have such pressure. It's a great kasha. It's a tremendous question. You don't see the answer to it, and then boom, you have the answer. And suddenly all the loose ends are tied together, all the questions are answered. It's the build up to the pressure, and then you have the answer. The later two books that we're going to discuss are stylized that way. That's the flow of the book. The first is not at all like that. And surprisingly, I actually found that the weakest of the books, but it was actually the most award-winning book, world-famous book, more than the other two. So I'm going to change the order and turn it into a Brisker book. So maybe you'll find that more exciting, or maybe you'll find it less exciting. We'll see. So let's discuss one problem. One problem is economic. We live in a global world. Obviously, global world. Capitalism, the economies are no longer local, they're global. They're trans-global, they go from one country to another. I used to work at what was at the time the biggest company in the world, Citigroup. At that time, Citibank merged with Travelers and became the largest company in the world, or at least the largest financial company in the world. It later failed and had to separate because it wasn't a good mix. But we have many global companies, and the economy really goes from one country to another, and there's no single location, there are no local economies. And what does that do? The number one thing it does is it makes the rich richer, and it makes the poor poorer. The people who are rich, who have the resources, who have the abilities, they're able to go into everyone else's economy and make themselves rich there. I mean, they're doing it by bringing services, by utilizing the resources, but it is, and we see this in the U.S., we see this in many other economies throughout the world. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. The poor countries are devastated in their poverty. And even in the rich countries like the U.S., we still see the billionaires are becoming richer, and the people who aren't, the working stiffs, they're struggling. And that's very destabilizing. It's destabilizing because the poor people resent that. They notice it, especially now where we see all these bailouts, we see the Goldman Sachs bonuses going on. There's a huge amount of resentment. And that's destabilizing to the economy. It's destabilizing politically. But more than that, when the whole world operates based on economics, morality takes a backseat. It's all about transactions, how to make money for your company, how to make money for yourself, and morality takes a backseat to that, especially when any company can look all over the world for another partner. So there's really no need to create any relationships, any long-standing bonds of trust, because there's no need for trust. You could always find some other partner somewhere else in the world, and that is destabilizing morally. Now, socially, and again, I can't go into it, the Chief Rabbi has great statistics, great anecdotes. One thing about the Chief Rabbi is that he's a great storyteller. I am a horrible storyteller. And since we realize, socially, there's a decline in marriage. We see it all around us. Divorce is rising. Single motherhood is a big problem. And families are destabilized. And when you don't have the families, there's a real loss of control. Everybody's struggling. You don't have control over your own lives. You're working nonstop, working longer hours. Even governments don't have control, which is surprising. You'd think they would. But I used to work for a Bermuda-based company that operated in the U.S. So all the money was made in the U.S., but it was Bermuda-based. Why was it Bermuda-based? Because the company didn't want to pay U.S. taxes, so they moved their base out of the U.S. And if Bermuda would be a problem, they'd move to Ireland. Any company who doesn't like the country, they just pick up and move. And the same with people. And we've seen this before. If the U.S. government has a warrant out for your arrest, you move somewhere else. who was that? Charlie Chaplin. What the U.S. government had a warrant out for his arrest. Granted, you know, it was I think it was J. Edgar Hoover who was behind that. But what did he do? He moved out of the U.S. and he stayed out. So the governments are losing control as well. And as consumers, well, what's happening to us? So we're having more and more choices presented to us, more and more products, more and more services. But what happens when you get more choice? In the end, you end up having less choice. There's just so much, you're overwhelmed, that what seems like more options, you just can't even choose. And it's overwhelming. Just keeping up with the amount of choices that we have is in itself a full-time job, and that takes away from our own free time as well. Now, all this change, and change is happening very quickly. It's happening much quicker now than it used to happen. And so all this change destabilizes people as well. It creates confusion. It creates an uncertainty about what's expected of you and what you can expect in the future. It used to be you'd get a job, you'd stay there for decades, you'd retire, you'd get a pension. Not anymore. You just don't know what's going to be 10 years down the road. When I first started out in business, so one of the standard questions that they'd ask in an interview was, where do you see yourself 10 years from now? I don't think they ask that question anymore because nobody knows. You have no clue. You don't know what you're going to be doing, where you're going to be working, and that's just a very destabilizing factor. Now, we all learn how to live with that, but what we end up learning how to live with is very unstable lives. And it's not the same, and it leads to greater confusion. And not only that, it leads to less identity. You don't quite know who you are, where you fit in, and damages relationships. Who can you create relationships with, and how do you create those relationships? We already said businesses. You don't have the same types of business relationships you used to have. But similarly, on a person-to-person level, you don't have the same kinds of relationships that you used to have. We don't have those long-term relationships. Not just because families are destabilizing, but the whole society is destabilizing. Now, one of the things that Chief Rabbi likes to talk about is conservation. He's a bit of an environmentalist, which makes me a little bit uncomfortable, not so much. I believe in conserving the environment also. This is where he brings most of the Torah that he has in the book in terms of conservation, because there's so much Torah about how we have to protect the environment, how when God created the Garden of Eden, he took Adam around and said, all this is yours, the whole world is yours, really, but make sure that you are in charge of guarding it. And that's why Adam was put, you know, one of the things that Adam was given to do when he was put in the Garden of Eden was La'avdo l'shomra, to work it and to guard it. And that's one of our jobs in the world as well, is to guard the environment, guard the world. To what degree? Well, that's an issue also. I mean, there are halachas about that. There are halachas about how we have to protect the environment. Many halachas are about protecting animals, protecting the environment. But on the other hand, there's a loophole or there's a leniency in most of those halachas. And that's if there's a need, if there's a real human need, then you don't have to be as careful. So, for example, there's a prohibition of Tsar Bali Chaim, of creating damage, pain to an animal. Which you're not allowed to needlessly do. You're not allowed to, you know, pick up some sort of a spider or whatever and start pulling the legs out. That's causing needless pain to an animal. But on the other hand, if there's a need for it, and this is codified in halacha, it's very standard. If there's a need, if you have to work an animal really hard in order to get your burden that he's carrying from from place A to place B, so that's allowed. So conservation is important, but you have to keep in mind that there are extenuating circumstances. But all that notwithstanding, and we're not even going to talk about global warming because there's really no need to go there, it's very clear that we are using of natural resources at an unprecedented pace, and we need to take a step back and think about that. For example, there's a story in the Gemara in Tanis about Choni, who was walking down and he saw a carob tree. Let me see if I can get this right here. Choni is walking and he sees a carob tree. And he asked the man standing next to it. No, I don't have it right here in the book. He asked the man standing next to it, you know, did you plant this tree? And he said, no, my grandfather planted the tree. And then the man is planting a tree for himself. When is that tree going to grow and be ripe? In 70 years from now. Why? So why are you planting it if you're never going to see it? Because my grandfather planted the tree for me, and I'm planting it for my grandchildren. And there's that sense that we have to take care of the environment, just like we were given a healthy environment. We have to give to our own grandchildren a healthy environment as well. Now here's where things get tough, because from a secular perspective, it's very difficult to create an environmental ethic. philosophically, why should you feel obligated to leave for your grandchildren a healthy environment? You know, from a philosophical perspective, it's very difficult to justify that obligation. You know, intuitively, from our gut, we see it. But philosophically, why should I care? They'll deal with whatever problems they have, just like I deal with whatever problems I have. And, you know, again, I'm simplifying this. This is a long conversation to have. This could be an hour-long discussion just itself. But that's a very important point, that from a secular perspective, there's really no surefire way of creating an environmental ethic. So what's the solution to all these problems? And these are big problems. We're talking about them quickly. We spoke about them in 15 minutes. These are big problems. These are social divisions that we see in the world. How do we solve those problems? So the chief rabbi comes up with his solution. His solution is very simple but very complicated. The solution is religion. Because religion stabilizes communities. It stabilizes families. Economically, it teaches that, we'll talk a little bit more about this, but it teaches that you have to care about other people, you have to create relationships, and there has to be trust. And you are bound religiously to create that trust and to abide by that trust. And that alone will stabilize the economy and stabilize the companies. It also creates an obligation on global companies not to abuse their workers and to try to distribute the wealth properly and adequately. Socially, religion gives identity. Like we were saying, times like this, where things are so complicated, where people don't quite know where they fit in, they don't know where their next job will be, they don't know where in the community they fit into, so religion will create a community and fit them into the world. It gives them morality. It gives them the ability to create relationships with other people. So here comes the most difficult part, and this is really what the book is all about, and that's what do you do when you have religious differences. So we're saying religion is very important, religion will stabilize the world, but the truth is, it doesn't stabilize the world, right? That's the elephant in the room. Religion is destabilizing the world. Number one, this is written in the wake of 9/11. 9/11 was caused by religious fanatics, to some degree. How can we even claim, it's outrageous to even suggest, that religion will solve any of the world's problems when really religion is what's creating the world's problems? Now, first of all, we have to admit, and religion has not created the world's problems. These are economic problems. These are political problems. These are people who feel they're abused economically and politically, and they lose their power, and they're trying to regain their power. But still, religion is a major part of it. So the solution to religious differences, according to the chief rabbi, is conversation. When you talk to each other, you might not resolve any of your problems, but the act of talking itself is conflict resolution. Instead of taking guns, taking airplanes, taking bombs, when you talk to each other, you might not solve any of your problems, and you might not compromise on anything, but what you're doing is you're talking, you're seeing each other as human beings, and you're sitting down and trying to work things out. Compromise. You know, I skipped two quotes that I had, which I'd like to go back to. Because I think my words are nowhere near as great as the chief rabbi. So let's go to the first excerpt here. This is his solution when he talks about how to stabilize the world. So economics can solve economic problems, and politics, political ones, but only religion can solve problems that arise out of the religious situation itself. For four centuries, the West proceeded on the assumption that science, politics, and economics would take the place once held by the church. The problem of religion would be solved by depriving it of power. What happens, though, when religion returns in all its power? Precisely because it answers questions to which science, politics, and economics offer no reply, right? For 100, 200 years, 400 years, the Western world thought that the answer to everything was progress, was to science, was to economics, was to understanding everything. But what happened? We realized that doesn't solve all the problems. And religion comes back to the equation because it stabilizes people, it gives them something to believe in. It gives them a way to know themselves. But what happens when religion comes in? The question is, can they make space for those who are not its adherents, who sing a different song, hear a different music, tell a different story? Right at the end of the 20th century, people came back to religion because secularism didn't solve their problems. Well, the next problem that we had was religion itself, because religions were fighting against each other. And that's what we see now with the religions fighting each other all over the world, whether Bosnia, Serbia, or India and Pakistan. So on that question, the fate of the 21st century may turn. It's a good question. That's what the chief rabbi says. So what happens when you talk to each other? There's a problem with that, and that problem is compromise. Because if you reach a compromise, you are literally compromising, you're giving in. You're losing some of your own religion or some of your own religious idealism. So let's read this excerpt right here. In a plural society, all the more so in a plural world, each of us has to settle for less than we do when we associate with fellow believers. You have to compromise. A Catholic may believe that abortion is murder, a Jew or Muslim that sex outside marriage is forbidden, and these convictions are given life within our respective communities of faith. So that's a problem. People have problems with that, and understandably, because you end up giving up some of your ideals for the sake of world peace. But we cannot seek to have them imposed by force of law on those who are not members of our community. If there are other groups who seriously disagree and make a compelling case for the right to construct a life along different lines. So he's saying, even if your religion prohibits something, you cannot turn that into law and force all other people from different religions to follow that. Now, here's a loophole. You could say, well, my religion permits taking drugs, and my religion permits prostitution. So there are people who do try to make that case in the U.S., and he adds in this caveat that you have to make a compelling case for the right to construct a life along different lines. But yet, what we lose is more than compensated for by the fact that together we are co-architects of a society larger than we could construct on our own. One in which our voice is heard and attended to even if it does not carry the day. You hear what he's saying? He's not saying compromise for the sake of world peace. He's saying compromise in order to build something bigger, in order to be part of something. You could be part of a small community that sticks to its ideals, or you could be part of a world community where you contribute and you have a voice. That is something much bigger. If you want to be part of something much bigger, you have to give a little. And I think, certainly from the Jewish perspective, this is not a problem at all that we would compromise in these ways. It's not talking about personal compromises like driving on Shabbos or violating any prohibition or anything like that. That's not what we're talking about at all. What we're talking about is compromise in order to allow other people to have their rights and to look at the world and observe the world in their way. Okay, so which comes to the next chapter, which is really not the next chapter, it's a different order, which is the most controversial chapter in the book. I mentioned before it's controversial, this book. Actually, the book, the version I have in front of me, let me hold it up, this, I don't believe, is available anymore. This was the first edition. It's hardcover. There was a second revised edition published a year later, 2 years later, I'm not sure exactly, because Jews in England believed that this book was bordering on heresy, if not heresy itself. Now, I have elsewhere written that I totally disagree with that accusation, and I think that they were just misreading the book. But be that as it may, what caused them such concern? And it's a chapter on religious pluralism. It's a chapter where the chief rabbi makes the case that we have to allow for other religions. Judaism teaches us that there's room for other religions in the world. Now, that should shock you, or maybe it shouldn't, but I think it will shock many people in the Jewish community. Because what's he talking about? There's idolatry, they have their own books, their own laws, or their lack of laws, and they do their own things totally differently. They have their statues, or they have their mosques, whatever they have. It's just crazy. And then you go to the Far East, you have all sorts of weird things going on there, certainly strange to the Jewish perspective. How could you say that we should allow for religious pluralism? Now, there are a lot of caveats in there. The number one caveat is mentioned even in the first edition, certainly in the second edition, about certain universal morals that are encompassed in the seven Noahide laws, Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach, that we assume that in order to be categorized as an adequate religion or a valid religion, you have to follow those. But assuming that these religions follow those seven laws, basic morality, religious morality, so then we have room for other religions. That's something that Judaism teaches, which most other religions don't. And that's, we have our religion, which we believe is true, but we don't obligate. We don't think everyone needs to do that. We're not a missionizing people who wants to go out and convert everyone to Judaism. We believe we follow our religion. You follow your path to God. Now, if you take that approach, then there's certainly room for us to have discussions with other religions. There's certainly room for us to sit down and talk to them about universal concerns, and I'm being very careful to speak within Rabbi Soloveitchik's parameters here. But there's certainly room for us to have a discussion and create a society together that has a religious core that allows for people to have their own identities and have a morality. And there's certainly room for more than one kind of person in this world. There's no need for different religions to be fighting against each other. Two other things that are important. Number one, three other things. Number one, which I think is the biggest contribution of this book, is that the Chief Rabbi argues for the morality of capital markets. A lot of people, they might look at the world, global capitalism, the rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer, say, this capitalism thing doesn't work at all. It's not working for us. We need socialism. We need some other ism. The Chief Rabbi says, absolutely not. Capital markets work. They are based on certain biblical ideas such as property rights, such as the dignity of man. There's a place for creativity, for work, for believing that wealth is God's blessing. These are beautiful ideas. This is what capital markets, what capitalism is all about, and this is what the Torah teaches us. There's room for capitalism. Not only is there room for capitalism, Torah teaches some sort of capitalism and certainly allows for capitalism as the best way to run a society. Self-interest. You might remember the movie from the 1980s, Wall Street, where there's a classic famous scene where the bad guy, what is his name, Gecko, something like that, says greed is good. And that has come to symbolize all that's bad about capitalism. But the truth is, it's not so bad. Self-interest is how capitalism works. Everybody works for their own self-interest. And there's a midrash that teaches pretty much the same thing. The world would not survive without self-interest. Here we have it. Precious Rabba, Tess, Zain, Rabbi Nachman, Bar Shmuel, Bar Nachman, Mishim, Rabbi Shmuel, Mishmen, Rabbi Shmuel, Bar Nachman, Omar. So he said this. Hinei tov me'od, after God created the world, he says, Hinei tov me'od, here is very good. Ze yetzer tov. V'hinei tov me'od, ze yetzer ra. So this is the Yetzer Hara. Tov Me'od, what does it mean, Tov Me'od? This is the Yetzer Hara. Now how can you say the Yetzer Hara? That's the inclination to do bad. It's a desire, the base human animal desires. How can you say that's good? So as the Midrash says, V'chi Yetzer Hara Tov Me'od. How can you say the Yetzer Hara is good? Very good. It's Maha. It's a question. Ela she'ilule the Yetzer Hara. Labana Adam Bayis. If it wasn't for the Yetzer Hara, no person would ever build a house. Nasa Isha, if a man didn't want a woman didn't want a man, there would be no marriage. Vilo Holid, there would be no children. Vilo Nasa Venasan, there would be no business, no one would make money. Of course you need the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara, self-interest, is how community, how social markets, how capital markets function. You couldn't have society without greed, without self-interest. So to say capital markets are bad, it just seems, it's very difficult. According to the Chief Rabbi, it's really not a Torah concept to say that capital markets are bad. But what you need is you need a compassionate market. You need to keep in mind the concepts of charity. The people who make money have to give money. The people who are poor need help. And there's tzedakah. There's an idea of doing charity, giving charity, doing good deeds, being kind to others. It's the obligation of the people who make the most out of capital markets to give back to those who do not in order to support the capital markets. If the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer, the capital markets, capitalism will not survive. For capitalism to survive, we need to have a compassionate capitalism. The people who make the money need to be able to need to give back. You need to have the Bill Gateses of the world and the Warren Buffets of the world who make billions of dollars and then give billions of dollars back to the world in order to try to equalize to some degree and to keep some sort of equilibrium so the capital markets, the capitalism can keep on continuing. Another thing we need to do is we need education. In order to keep, to create a little balance, you need a lot of education. We live in an information age, and without education, people who live in third world countries will never succeed. They'll continue getting poorer. That is the wrong excerpt that I just pulled up. I'm going to move on in a minute. Okay, once again, the wrong excerpt, and besides which, we're out of time for this book. Anyway, let me just keep moving. Let me just tell you one other idea that is crucial to this book, and that's the idea of a covenant. We need to see every human being needs to see every other human being in the world as partners in creating a world society, and creating a capitalism, and creating a social environment in which we all can succeed together. When everybody looks out for himself, the society will not work. What we need is what he calls a covenant. Covenant is a group of people working together for the same cause. This is going to come up again and again. But the way the chief rabbi sees the solution to the problem of global problems is to create a global covenant of everybody working on certain basis of morality, certain basis of the same rules, and then everyone, the capitalism can continue functioning, the society can continue functioning to the future. Now, I'm running out of time, so let's move on to the next book, which is how to apply ideas like this to a country. Western countries, the U.S., England, are suffering right now. This is supposed to be the cover to the book, The Home We Build Together. I'm not sure how well you can see that. This book is about England. It applies equally to the U.S., or a little less to the U.S., and to every other Western country. The chief rabbi says there are three models to how you can build a society. One model is a townhouse, which worked very well for many years. And that's the people who belong, who are in the country. They're the owners of the townhouse. Anybody who immigrates or who comes to visit, they're guests in the townhouse. If they don't assimilate into the mainstream, they will remain guests, and they will not have real ownership in the country. Only people who assimilate into the main group, they can become owners of the townhouse and real owners, full participants in the society. The second model is a hotel where everybody is a guest. There is no owner. There's no one society. There's no one culture. It's everybody has their own culture. Excuse me, and they all live together. And the third model is enigmatic and is the title of the book and is what we're going to be talking about. And that's where you see society as a home that everybody builds together. Now, this book is particularly critical of multiculturalism. Multiculturalism is, you could say, the big evil of the book. And multiculturalism is the hotel model that we just discussed, where everybody comes together in one country, but everybody keeps their own culture. You have the people from the Caribbeans keeping their Caribbean culture. You have the people from South America, from Latin America, from each different country coming to the U.S. or to England, maintaining their own culture, speaking their own languages, dressing in their own ways, acting in their own ways. You have people from Russia, from all over the place. I'm about to get to where it started. And there are three reasons why multiculturalism came to be. Number one is the idea that we have different ideals from different cultures. They cannot be mixed together. They are inherently unable to be combined together. The ideas and the ideals do not combine. They collide. And there's no way for any one person to assimilate all of them into his being. Which means that anyone who comes from any culture and wants to retain that culture, they cannot absorb anything from any other culture. This was a philosophical idea that was common in the 1950s and 1960s. Number two is a recognition that nationalism has failed. Nationalism was, of course, big in the 1800s and the early 1900s, but what happened was it just did not succeed. It just caused more and more conflict. It was supposed to resolve conflict, but what it really did is it caused more conflict. And the third is a recognition of what we saw in the Eichmann trials, and that's conformity. What was the answer to how the Nazis, what did they say to how they committed all those atrocities? They said they're just following orders. They're doing what they were told. They were just doing what everybody else was doing. There was a recognition that conformity leads to evil, what they call the banality of evil. You just do what everybody else is doing, do what you're told, and that doesn't work. So conformity into the main culture can turn into a very evil thing. And because of all this, in the 1960s and the 1970s, really the 1970s, multiculturalism came to be. Now remember what happened in the late 1960s. There was also this rebellion against authority. There was a rebellion, a loss of faith in culture, a loss of faith in authority. Someone raised his hand. Feel free to add in a comment if you want to chat. And what happens when everyone maintains their own culture is that there's no consensus. There's no consensus of morality. There's no consensus of how things should be and how people should speak to each other. There's no moral language at all. It's just everybody has rights, and everybody has this authenticity. You have to be authentic to your own culture, to who you are. Let me pull up a quote here from the book. The moral consensus disappears, and moral conversation dies. Opponents are demonized, right? Your culture is the best culture. Everyone else's culture, they're the worst. Ever new isms are invented to exclude even ever more opinions. New forms of intimidation begin to appear. Protests, threats of violence, sometimes actual violence. For when there are no shared standards, there can be no conversation. And where conversation ends, violence begins. Very true words, very scary words. And these are words that we see. We see in, as Jay pointed out, in Canada, we see it in the US, they see it in England. This is a problem. When we can't talk to each other, when we insist we're right, you're wrong, then that society falls apart. And that leads to violence. It leads to serious cultural problems. One thing multiculturalism does is it exaggerates the differences between people instead of emphasizing the similarities. And how do you win the multicultural game? There's a game going on. And how do you win the game? By becoming a victim. Because when you become a victim, suddenly all your needs have to be addressed by everybody else. So what multiculturalism inevitably leads to is a politics of victimhood. A lot is how much they've been wronged. And it's a focus on the past. It's not a focus on the future. It leads to nowhere, because all it is people fighting for each other for a piece of the pie based on what happened in the past. Everybody works for themselves, and nobody works together for a greater good, because there is no greater good. There is no commonality to have a common good. And with technology, it becomes even worse. Everybody creates their own media. They have their own satellite station. They have their own websites. They talk to each other. And when you talk to each other only, what you end up having is you create this echo chamber. People just talk to each other, and they get more and more excited, more and more impressed by their own uniquenesses, by their own strengths of their own culture, and nobody ever talks to anybody else. They create their own blogs, even their own Torah blogs, that somebody points out. There's no national conversation. There's only cultural conversation within your own little subgroup. So what's the solution, right? We've been building up to the kasha. We haven't got kasha after kasha after kasha, problem after problem after problem. So what's the terrence? The terrence is what Rabbi Sacks says, Chief Rabbi Sacks says in The Home We Build Together, you have to create a national culture. The only way out of this dilemma that we all see ourselves is to create a national culture. Bare bones doesn't have to be the most intense culture that can exist, but we have to create a culture that is common to everybody. find the lowest common denominator and turn that into a national culture. What we need is, and this is a word that keeps popping up again, we need a covenant. We need to be able to work together as a group towards some goal. And when we work together, we break down the barriers. We instead of only talking to each other, instead of only talking to ourselves, we start talking to each other. When you have a shared fate, when you have a national culture and you see a national goal, you have a shared fate. And that's when relationships begin. Relationships of trust. You're able to talk to each other and trust each other. And that is what a society is made of. That will continue in the future, in the long term, and allow for society to continue. Pull up a quote here from this book. Here we go. There's a difference between history and memory. History is someone else's story. It is about events that happened somewhere else, sometime else. Memory is my story. It is about events that happened in some sense to me. History answers the question, what happened? Memory answers the question, who am I? And this is what a country needs to do. It needs to create a shared memory. It needs to create a national story. He calls it a narrative, which is, in a postmodern world, is a loaded term. But we need to create a national narrative. And he points to the U.S., which to some degree has that. We have George Washington chopping down the apple tree. We have Abraham Lincoln. We have national heroes. And a national plot line which allows for loyalty and patriotism. You need patriotism. Now, in the U.S., it's becoming less popular to be patriotic, and we need to emphasize that. In England, they have almost lost that entirely, and they need to recreate that by creating a national story. In the U.S., we have July 4th. We have an Independence Day. England needs to create something of that nature, to have a national day that they can celebrate, a national story that they can tell. Whether it's national songs or national poems, that you need to create a national culture that transcends all of these different multicultural subgroups, and to create a common language, a common morality through these stories. The stories tell the morality, and to create a common morality so that everybody works on the same basis, everybody operates on the same morality and within the same story. It'll create loyalty. There'll be more social cohesion. And this is something when you look to the past, you think about it, you realize it's so obvious, of course. When you're patriotic, you all go out to the parades together. You know, on my block, I have an American flag hanging in front of my home. And it doesn't matter whether you're Italian, whether you're Jewish, what nationality, what religion, what ethnicity. Almost everybody has an American flag hanging out. And it's a patriotic side. We support the troops. And we got on our car, our minivan, a little support the troops magnet. It's a national story, a national loyalty, a patriotism that unites people. So how do you do it? How do you create this national story? So there are many different ways. But one of them is, like we said, to create a national narrative, have a celebratory day, create these common values, stories that teach these common values. Most importantly, you have neutral spaces. Charities, non-government organizations, churches, schools. The government has to fund these, have to allow these to flourish. But they must be depoliticized. You can't have charities that are causing problems and undermining the government. You have to have charities that are supporting the government and supporting the national story. Pull up this quote here. Ideological politics, the politics that seeks to invade and conquer the totality of public life, is incompatible with civil society. So talking about ideology, convinced that it alone has the truth, it has no patience for impartiality, fair procedures, reason, debate, it speaks, it does not listen, it knows it has no space for doubt, it sees the even-handedness of civil discourse as a weakness to be exploited, not a strength to be respected. Now, we have to allow for all different cultures, but the one culture for which the chief rabbi has no patience is a culture that tries to undermine this commonality, this common culture. People who try to do that, organizations that try to do that, are not part of our common culture. We do not share with them the covenant. We do not share with them a common fate. Here we go. This raises an intensely delicate issue. To what extent should a liberal state fund non-liberal institutions? Now, he's not talking about politically, whether you're a Tory or whatever else they call it in England, Republican, Democrat. He means liberal in terms of allowing for this national culture. This is a political question, not a moral one, but the following principles suggest themselves. A. Governments may fund non-liberal institutions so long as they are purely voluntary. People have a free choice as to whether to enter or leave. B. There is equal provision available elsewhere. State schools, non-religious adoption agencies, and so on. C. The institutions are based on values compatible with political, not moral, liberalism. In other words, the government should be funding religions. It should be funding religious institutions. It should be funding religious schools so long as there are non-religious schools and non-religious institutions available for people who don't want the religious choice. And that religion does not seek to undermine patriotic common loyalty and the common good. Okay, let's move on because we're running out of time. Let's move on to the third book, Future Tense. How does this apply to the State of Israel? State of Israel has a lot of problems. It's a great place, and when we talk about this, you know, it's very difficult to speak about problems in the State of Israel because of the concept of Dibas Haaretz. You don't want to say bad things about Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, if you want to be critical in a constructive way, there's much value there. We can only solve problems if we recognize them and then move on to the next step of solving them. So I'm going to have to move very quickly because I spoke way too long already. As I mentioned before, I always over-prepare, and I apologize for that. And again, we're trying to do, let's say, 50 lectures in one, which you can only get on Torah in Motion, but we have to move quickly. The problem in the world is, what is Judaism? Judaism is not attracting the youth, and part of the reason for that is because Judaism has been made very unattractive. Judaism is portrayed to people as protecting ourselves from anti-Semitism. It's some sort of an ethnicity, a culture, something you can opt for. It's a little nice. You have a little herring and some pastrami and rye. That's not something that will attract people. It's not something that will retain people in the fold. People think that Judaism has to be made easier. For example, you know, we have to find leniencies and try to make it very comfortable so that anyone can observe all of Judaism. But here's a proof that that's not true. The chief rabbi says this. What is the most observed holiday in the Jewish calendar? It's not anything that's easy. It's Pesach. The Pesach Seder is the most observed ritual, Jewish ritual, and Pesach Seder is very hard. Pesach Seder is probably the hardest of all the Jewish rituals. It's not easy, but the Pesach Seder tells a story. It's part of the family heritage. It's part of the national heritage. In the 1800s, racial anti-Semitism. In the early 20th century also, it was justified by pseudoscience. Anti-Zionism is justified by pseudo-human rights. I can't elaborate on that. The solution to all these problems. And let's go to Israel for a minute. In the Israeli culture, the state of Israel, the state of Israel is facing something called post-Zionism, where there is no national culture anymore. We were talking before about how England and the U.S. needs to have a national culture, a national narrative. Israel does not have that. Israel has this political system with many parties that constantly conflict. So Israel, in many ways, is about fighting. It's about different subgroups fighting each other for the rights that they want, for the power that they want. So the solution to everything that we've had is as follows. This is what the chief rabbi says. And I'm skipping because I need to fit into the framework right now. Judaism or Israel needs a society based on a covenant. We've talked about covenant before. Covenant in which everyone in the country works together towards the same goal. Society kept Jews going. We had a society that kept Jews going in exile for 2,000 years. And Israel now needs a society also. Not just a state, not just politics. It needs a society. It needs a social framework, a social basis, so they have a shared language, a shared morality. And where does that come from? Where should this shared culture come from? The answer is obvious. Judaism. Religion needs to become the national culture. Now, how do you do that? Number one, religion must be depoliticized. That's the first thing the chief rabbi says. And it's three ways on how to do this. But number one, religion needs to unify people. It cannot be one of the political parties fighting against the other political parties. Religion is about society. It is not about state. And it needs to be depoliticized. Israel needs a narrative, a national narrative. When I grew up, Israel had a national narrative. It had heroes. It had a story. But post-Zionism has destroyed all that. It has destroyed the heroes. It has destroyed the history. Every heroic action has turned into an atrocity, which is not true. Israel needs to reclaim its narrative and reclaim its history so that it has heroes, it has a culture, it has a shared language of heroics, of patriotism. Israel needs, once again, and I'm not saying it's not right now, but it needs to grow and become even more patriotic. And Israel, you need to empower civil society. You know, the Haredi world in Israel, they do not get much of a secular education, but the surprising thing is that even in the non-Haredi world, they're not getting that much of a secular education. If you look at the statistics, education in Israel is really not up to par. And that's an understatement of where it is and where it needs to get to. That has to be a focus. You have to focus on the education to create a civil society that is knowledgeable of its own history and knowledgeable of its future and its potential. Jews like to argue. Israelis like to argue a lot. And what Israel needs is to create conversation. It needs to learn the art. Again, this is a British chief rabbi, an Englishman speaking. Israel needs to learn the art of civil conversation, where you speak to each other, where you listen to each other. Knesset has a lot of shouting in it and not as much listening as it needs to have. And that's the entire country needs to move to a new level of conversation. The chief rabbi gives 10 principles of Judaic conversation, which is fascinating in itself. Let me just read you the titles. Oh, we're running out of time. Let me just read you the titles. Number one, God lives in language. Number two, by discovering the other, we discover ourselves. Number three, when words end, violence begins. You have to keep talking. Number four, listening is a religious act. Number five, to hear, you have to listen. Number six, without argument, there is no justice. Number seven, argument for the sake of truth and heaven. Number eight, to reach truth, you must listen to the other side. Number nine, the dignity of dissent. And number ten, argument as a mode of conflict containment. Argue, disagree, And that's a way to keep people from fighting. So yes, as someone points out, the secular religious divide is big, but by bringing religion down out of the government and creating a national narrative based on religion, not requiring everybody, not having police going out and requiring everyone to keep all the commandments, but be creating a national conversation and a national language that is based on religion, you will shorten that divide. You'll make it much smaller. Now, in reality, this is a pretty depressing ending. I'm skipping a lot of the book because I have to. But trust me on this. When I finished the book, or got near the end, I was pretty depressed. Because how realistic is any of this? Not very. At least to me. But the chief rabbi isn't going to leave it off at that. He leaves off on a note of optimism. He has a whole chapter about the future and the possibilities of the future. He points out that other animals, such as dolphins, they may have language. But only human language has a future tense, which is the title of the book. Only we could talk about the future and we could think of the future. We can hope for change and we can work for change. Like it says, Judaism is about a challenge and we have to live up to the challenge. We talked about this last week also, how the chief rabbi encourages people to become religious and to inspire them about Judaism, because Judaism is a challenge. And Israel faces a big challenge now, but with these ideas and these principles of how to create a society that can work together and move forward, there really is hope there. Judaism is about building a better world. And let me just leave off with a quote from the chief rabbi towards the end of his book. To be a Jew is to be an agent of hope. Every ritual, every command, every syllable of the Jewish story is a protest against escapism, resignation, and the blind acceptance of fate. Judaism, the religion of the free God, is a religion of freedom. Jewish faith is written in the future tense. It is a belief in a future that is not yet, but could be. If we heed God's call, obey His will, and act together as a covenantal community, the name of the Jewish future is hope. And with that, I just want to conclude and just tie everything together a little bit. The main point that the chief rabbi is trying to get across is that we need to bridge the differences that we face right now in the world that we face in Israel, in the U.S., in England, and in the whole world. There are a lot of differences, and we need to, through conversation and through a mutual language, through shared relationships, and through building trust and a shared language, we can overcome all those differences, each in their own way. He starts off with the global problems, moves on to each country's problems, and then moving on to Israel itself, which is something that we can all relate to and maybe even all contribute to. And by creating conversations and a dialogue and some base level of understanding of language and morality, we can move forward and reduce the tension and create more positive results. Now, if anyone has any questions, now's the time to ask. I just want to talk about what we're going to speak about next week. Next week is going to be a little different. We're going to have a little more, you might call it Torah content. We're going to be talking about new trends in Torah commentary, recently published books that have some of these newfangled approaches and what do they mean and how are they done, and give some really good examples that are very attractive and very interesting about how to look at the Torah in different ways and how people are doing that right now and where things have headed currently and where they're heading in the future. So if anyone has any questions, feel free. Now, again, you can download all these handouts from the file share box. If not, I thank everybody for coming on and for listening. And I'm going to stay on for a little bit. So feel free. Just leave your comments in the chat box, and please send them to everyone, not just to me. Thank you very much, and have a good night.